any other excuse me, preliminary issues or questions? I'm thinking we're going to finish next Tuesday, which again will be our last day of covering new material. We should just be finishing chapter 3 at that point. So we might finish a little early and get into chapter 4. We might be still grinding away just to get there. And if you brought your exam with you and would like to return it, that would be great. Any other preliminary issues or questions? Excuse me. Okay, well, yesterday we left off in the middle of this discussion about how to identify who gets, in effect, to take a number at the Baskin-Robbins of tort recovery, and who is told, in effect, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. As I said yesterday, this is, to a large extent, jurisdictional. That is, each jurisdiction has the freedom to define for itself how broadly or how restrictively it will define the eligibility criteria. Typically, these are a matter of court decision, so that judges over time develop through the case law the criteria, as we saw in Dillon versus Legg and in Rodriguez, and they change them from time to time. One other possibility, not very often, but as it happens in Washington, there's a specific statute. You may recall it was mentioned in Harbison versus Park Davis. There is a legislative enactment that says parents may recover for damage to the relationship with a child where the child is injured or killed by the defendant's fault or negligence. So there, instead of going to the judge and saying, gee, this makes a lot of good public policy sense that under these facts, this parent should be able to recover for a loss of consortium or for the loss of consortium with the child, instead of having to make that pitch and get the number, essentially the legislature has said all parents get a number at the Baskin-Robbins of litigation for injury or death of a child. But as I say, that's pretty unusual that the legislature would actually specify what counts, or for that matter, what doesn't count. More likely it is that the courts will adopt various kinds of criteria. So again, I'm returning to the to California here with the three cases of Dillon versus Legg and Rodriguez and now Borer, in part because this isn't even a jurisdictional difference. It in theory is one unified system, and yet it illustrates the difficulty that both the majority and the dissent have in providing some kind of bright line. They do provide a very bright line as to what's recoverable and what's not, but the majority is, at least in the dissenting view, less than persuasive in justifying why the line is being drawn where it is. So why don't we have somebody tell us about the facts in Borer and what the court said, and then we can talk about the merits of it. Go ahead. No, she didn't. And their rationale for claiming that they are entitled to their own, number at the Baskin-Robbins, what's their basic argument as to why they... all the wonderful things that mothers do for their children. She's no longer able to do, at least to the same degree that she had been before. And while they're, in addition to sort of making this argument in the abstract as to why this is good public policy, more specifically in terms of citing relevant authority as to why this is not only a good idea, but is... well, would actually be the court has no choice, in effect, but to give them a recovery, what would their legal authority be? Well, Dillon versus Legg talks about being... yeah, Rodriguez. I mean, obviously they're not... this is a different kind of relationship. It's not husband and wife, but it is an important relationship, child-parent. And to the extent that Mrs. Rodriguez was allowed to recover for an injury to her husband because their relationship had been damaged, her life had been altered because of the injury to her husband, the children of Mrs. Borer, say, were in exactly the same legal position. The injury to our mother... has affected us, and the court doesn't give us any feel for this in a way that's comparable to Rodriguez. We got in some detail exactly what Richard's injuries were, and we got a much clearer picture of the way in which Marianne's life had been changed as a result of this injury. We don't get such a clear picture of how the Borer children, but you can imagine. I mean, suppose you have testimony that Mrs. Borer, prior to the accident, did, you know, all of these different things, as you might imagine, as a mother of 9 children, that following the accident she was affected by the pain of her injury or the disability of her injury or the effect of medication she had to take and so forth and so on, and that, the transition or the change was from having this very close relationship, the children were essentially left to fend for themselves. That mom's in rehab she's taking oxytocin or whatever that stuff is that Rush Limbaugh got addicted to, and she can't function anymore. Okay, does that give them a right to recover?
I don't
think, well, you're right. The court says, well, that's different. Mrs. Rodriguez was entitled to recover, but you're not. Yeah. Right. Well, that's the critique of the dissent. You know, on what basis does the majority justify their denial of compensation to these children? Okay, so this is the idea that the nature of the damages are speculative, or it's not like compensating somebody for lost wages. How do I measure the damage that I suffer when, 8-year-old Christopher comes to Patricia Borer and says, "Mommy, read me a story," and Patricia says, "Yeah, you." You know, Christopher, you know, sorrowfully walks away from whacked out mom, you know. We're supposed, yeah, I mean, this is a sad thing. It's, you know, how whatever success we have in life, our parents made possible and so forth. But again, this is precisely the argument that was made, or one of the arguments made in the Rodriguez case. How do you evaluate Marianne's loss from Richard's injury? The court said, what was the court's answer to the defendant's claim in the Rodriguez case? When yeah, Ms. Wisely? Yeah, exam. Juries do that all the time. So they could do it here. No, says the court, they can't. You know, that's a bad idea. Other reasons why the court refuses to provide a remedy. Okay, and when you look at the reality of it, here's Patricia Borer. There's no discussion of her husband's claim. And maybe that never appears in this because everybody takes for granted that that would be covered by Rodriguez. Let's suppose he weren't in the picture and we have, on the one hand, Patricia Borer recovering for this falling light fixture. Well, what the plaintiffs are saying is multiply that by 10. We have Patricia Borer and her 9 children. We now have 10 plaintiffs where before there was only one. So, talk about the floodgates here. This is not an insignificant augmentation of the scope of liability. If you might think of this again, I sort of, you know, expanding the guest list a little bit. I throw a dinner party and I'm expecting 8 people, and one of them brings a friend of theirs, and we find another plate and silverware and sure we can fit one more at the table versus inviting somebody to go with you to dinner and a movie and that person and their 9 friends show up. There's a big difference between saying, hey, well, we can make one place for room for one more versus suddenly we've got an order of magnitude different in terms of the number of plaintiffs. But again, this is the idea of the floodgates. What did the court say in Rodriguez? When they argued that we were going to open the floodgates by allowing these loss of consortium claims? Right. We know just how far we're opening the gates here, and in effect, the court said, well, gee, if Marianne's injury is otherwise worthy of compensation, it's not a very good answer to say, sorry, take a number, I'm busy. If she deserves a recovery, why we ought to figure out a way to accommodate her claim. So, Mr. Brown. It's hard to tell. I mean, here again, one of the things that we do in reading these cases is we look at what judges do. How do judges decide cases? And judges decide cases one at a time. You want the judge to be thinking over the horizon, well, yeah, hard cases make bad law. Let me think about what general principle I'm adopting when I decide this case because I want to think about what sort of long-term effects it will have. But by the same token, you tend to get affected by the merits or the appeal of a particular fact pattern. So I would not I wouldn't be able to say that it would make no difference to the court that instead of having this abstract Patricia Borer gets hit by a light fixture, we don't know whether she got a broken arm or whether she had, you know, compression of her discs and she was in this terrible, you know, pain and in and out of surgery and so forth and so on. We get nothing of the details of it, nor do we, again, if you had a single mother with a special needs kid where you had very extensive testimony of the child's, you know, just being able to emerge from this burden that the child was suffering from because mother was such, you know, Helen Keller story, what's the movie that was teacher, whatever that, a miracle worker, yeah, you know, you have somebody that opens the door for this child and if it were a fact pattern like that, maybe the court would be moved to say, how could I say no to the child in this case? Whereas the court has a relatively easy time comparing this what seems to be virtually unlimited liability. I don't think it helps, just to be fair to the majority, when you look at the dissenting opinion that has no shortage of critical comments to make and essentially finding unpersuasive the majority's distinction between this case and Rodriguez, you know, to put it in more aggressive terms, you know, were you lying then or are you lying now? You know, when you said all this stuff in Rodriguez, was that insincere and we should go back and revisit Rodriguez? Or are you being insincere? I mean, that's kind of the critique of the dissenting opinion. But again, in fairness to the majority, when you look at the dissent, you ask the dissent, compared to what? Where's your dividing line? If you're not ready to say no to the children in this case, will you ever be able to say no? Will it be when we get to the first cousins once removed and the other members of the Jack and Jill softball team and the pen pals from third grade? I mean, where is it that you will say, in effect, we're done? The dissent can't even describe what that limit might look like. They just say, I don't want to do it now. And so I'm tempted to think back to my to the days when I had small children at home, and they get fussy at a certain time of the evening, and they're so tired that they don't want to go to sleep, you're thinking, well, maybe if I just sort of humor them for a little while longer, then they'll happily nod off, and I don't want to put them in their room and have them scream their head off. On the other hand, if they're going to scream their head off anyway, you know, I'd rather have them scream their head off at 7:30 and have the rest of the evening than to humor them for another 2 hours and then put them to bed and have them scream their head off, you know, 2 hours later. So I think that the majority is essentially saying, wherever we draw this line, you're always going to make these kinds of arguments. You're going to be able to say, well, you did it over here, why can't you do it here? And if we're going to have to draw the line someplace and the dissent isn't telling us it's ever going to get easier, there is no logical place to say, well, just go with us one more step here, and when we get here, it'll all work out from there. Everybody will say, yes, this is the end of the line. There's no more ground for compensation. We've done what we can. It's over. I don't know that we'll ever get there. There will always be pressure to go from here to there. Well, what they're trying to say is that We're not suggesting that pain and suffering, emotional pain and suffering, is not real loss. To the extent that the plaintiffs are saying, in effect, to decide in this case against the plaintiff's claim is to sort of badmouth intangible loss, pain and suffering, the court says, we're not saying that. We're not turning our back on it. We're just saying a child's claim for loss of consortium with a parent has to be judged on its own merits, and so we're, so, yeah. Tell me about that. Like amending a complaint, or? It used to be called collateral estoppel or res judicata. Issue preclusion, I think, is the new to me. It's 10 years old. Well, this is I believe in the back of the court's mind is the theory that if Patricia Borer's claim is well presented, and when the jury goes to assess Patricia Borer's damages, the plaintiff's lawyer asks the jury to compensate her for her inability to perform. Instead of having Christopher, 8-year-old Christopher, put him on the witness stand like, you know, Miracle on 34th Street, and, you know, have him testify here. Instead of having him talk about it, what we do is we have Patricia Borer testify, you know, that she was running upstairs to grab something, and she overheard Mary say to Elizabeth, you know, I would have asked Mom to do it, but, you know, she's just so far gone these days. Again, you play the violin for the jury for Patricia, and then the jury writes a big check to her. Patricia takes the check home and distributes it to the children. We're getting compensation to these kids, but we're doing it through Patricia rather than having each of them ask for it. If that logic is persuasive, however, we have to kind of run it backwards again, go back, revisit Rodriguez. Should that have persuaded us in the Rodriguez case, that if Richard and Marianne are as close as they claimed they were, why can't we give a boatload of money to Richard and he will share that with Marianne so that whatever loss she is entitled to be compensated for is available through the compensation to Richard. Now, it may be that the logic is different because the spousal relationship is different from the parent-child relationship, but again, this is precisely the area in which you start scratching your head and saying, I wish somebody would get me out of this because my head's beginning to hurt. I can't quite keep all this stuff straight. Now, again, the dissenting opinion complains that we're not coming to a logical conclusion, we're coming to a very arbitrary conclusion. Again, sort of reverting to parent mode here. You get the persistent question, but why, Daddy? Why? Why that? Why? And then finally, Daddy says, because I said so. And the court, in effect, in Borer says, because we say so. We've made a policy determination that this kind of claim pushes the system too far, is too speculative, is potentially duplicative. We acknowledge the claims for loss of consortium and the spousal relationship. We're just not going to do it in the parent-child relationship. And again, even if you are persuaded that ought to be done in the parent-child relationship, what about relationships that are not directly parent-child, but are like parent-child? The parental figure in a child's life who's injured, and the child is claiming, Uncle Fred or Aunt Susan played the same role in my life that Patricia Borer played in the lives of her children, and therefore I shouldn't be discriminated against just because I didn't share chromosomes with this person for whom I want compensation. So again, the court has to make up its mind. Do we adopt flexible criteria that say it's not arbitrary labels that matter, it is quality and you kind of have this in the very, very old days, the early days of television, they would have Queen for a Day. And women would appear, telling their sort of hard luck stories, and then they would have these applause meters. There was some kind of measuring device of, how much sympathy they were able to draw. And then the one that got the greatest response was made Queen for the Day, and she would get a washing machine, and she would get, these other things. It was, you could sort of see Jerry Springer off in the distant horizon that eventually would come to that. But again, if you want this kind of emotive, how much does it make my heart go pity-pat to listen to this story, versus saying, no, the lines we're going to draw are more explicit, and they're more arbitrary. It has to fit these criteria. And if you don't fit these criteria, even though you say you're an awful lot like it, that isn't good enough. And I would also, point out, as I think I said before, this potential for the legal system to become intrusive to the extent that it forces people to it forces the courts to make judgments about the quality of relationship and say, oh, gee, you've got a really important relationship, but no, your relationship is unimportant. And whether that's better done by a statute, again, it goes back to the wrongful death criteria. It's part of what is at stake in this Filippides case I mentioned before, pending before the Washington Supreme Court. Do you want to get into the business of measuring whether somebody's relationship with a parent or with someone else is really important, if they are dependent for, or if they are, dependent for support? Do you trust juries or judges to evaluate relationships, or is that kind of creepy and destructive? I think I said to somebody after class earlier this week that when I taught family law once upon a time, and periodically I get involved in one way or another in something involving custody questions, and the process of evaluating parents, two parents whose marriage is dissolved, and each claims that they are the better custodian of the child, and the process of saying, oh, this one's a better parent than that one, the child would be better off to be in the custody of this parent and give the other parent only limited visitation rights, making that comparative determination, particularly for a child who's 8 or 10 watching this go on, that's a pretty destructive thing. And the thought occurred to me in studying this and observing it that in some cases, at least, where the parents were at least comparable in terms of their parenting skills, it would be better off to just flip a coin, to say the reason you're going to be awarded custody is because I flipped the coin and it came up heads. And if I were on the losing end of that determination, instead of saying, you mean the parenting of my child was determined by the flip of a coin, I think I would feel better that that was said than that a judge who knew precious little about the relationship I had with my child or about what my spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse, to say, in effect, oh, she would be a better parent than me, I would find that far more revolting than the idea that at some point, you know, we really can't improve upon blind chance here. At least the process of trying to improve upon it, to have some judge make a determination about who's going to be a better parent, would be profoundly upsetting. So again, the whole question about what the tort system can do well, and at what point we say the tort system turns on itself at a certain point, instead of achieving greater justice and balancing and compensating and restoring equilibrium in a society, that the tort system winds up distorting or injuring these delicate kinds of relationships. Okay, I want, yeah. The trust fund was a grant of congressional generosity. It was designed to avoid the process of finding fault. You know, I think for a lot of people, the idea that you would say, and again, it's a sort of almost a superseding cause argument to say, maybe somebody was negligent in operating an airline or in building this building or whatever, but to sort of say, to even invite people to file tort claims in which they said it's your fault that these 3,000 people died in the World Trade Center, that was so contrary to what we wanted in terms of a national mood at that point, that they would say, let's just write a big check. I can't remember what it was, $30 billion, something in that range, I think, that was set aside for the compensation of these victims. That's too much. That's $10 million per victim. But it was a very, very substantial sum that was set aside, and then they got to essentially divide it up to say, okay, and in effect, they were sort of devising estate plans for all these people. If this person died, who do we think they would have wanted to share in the proceeds of this compensation? So let's say I'm a stockbroker on the 43rd floor of the World Trade Center, and I'm not married, I'm 34 years old, I've had various kinds of relationships through my life, and the court makes, or this compensation board makes a determination, well, this guy's parents deserve this much, but then there's this friend that this guy had. And, it's not a crazy idea to say that friend made a pretty good pitch as to how he or she was devastated by the event, and made a pretty good showing that this guy, if he had had a choice in how the money was distributed, wouldn't say, oh, give $1.3 million to my parents, whom I see at Christmas only because I kind of have to, but don't leave a dime, you know, to this person that I was dating or, you know, something else. Again, where you have that, and again, the legislature could codify such a compensatory scheme by setting up a fund that says, or setting up a distribution mechanism that says, we'll appoint some commissioner of wrongful death who will be empowered to make similarly kinds of discretionary decisions. we could do that. But again, I think that having people judge other people's, you know, the quality of other people's relationships, to sort of invite the friend to badmouth the parents and talk about how they used to go drinking together and Joe, the decedent, complained bitterly about, you know, sort of like as good as it gets or something. You know, this is the way my parents treated me and this is why I'm so miserable. Well, you know, is that something you really want to invite? Have a, again, a sort of queen for a day, applause meter, you know, it's unseemly. Better to have something that's arbitrary that says, these people get this much, and then we're done. It's another reason why people say, bag the whole idea of non-economic compensation. It all ought to be on the basis of economics. Because we can measure economics, we can't measure non-economic stuff. Okay, well let's make then the transition here to section C. Again, just to review the bidding here of where we've been. Section A, we did an inventory of the types of damages, and we will continue to utilize those categories of damages as we tweak the calculation of the recovery in the cases that follow. The middle section, section B, we just finished, had to do with deciding who is entitled to compensation. So, you know, again, this whole question related parties and that sort of thing. Now, in section C, it's kind of, this is an even more miscellaneous category of a miscellaneous category. It's essentially assuming we're going to make an award to A, B, or C, how do we go about determining the size of the award to be made? And again, in section B, we were fighting over whether an award was going to be made at all. Now we're assuming an award's going to be made, and we're trying to figure out how much it's going to be. And the first question that I ask in the beginning of section C is there such a thing as an award that's too much? We give the jury the discretion, as we've talked about before, to make these calculations or to assess how much is a fair award. Is it? Does there come a point at which we say the jury exceeded its authority? And the answer is, yeah, there is such a point, but it's not. Well, we'll talk about it. Can somebody tell us about Nicole Fortman and her? Yeah, Ms. Walker, go ahead. They used to call those suicide doors, the ones that open that way. Yeah, go ahead. And this is the body of law we'll take up in Chapter 9 on product liability, it's sort of a variation on the theme in Chapter 1. So the breach of duty is established, the causation is established. Now we need to determine how much does Nicole Fortman deserve by way of compensation. present value. Present value. But it's actually the present cash value of her future medical expenses would be $16 million. So she gets actually $16 million in her hands today to cover her medical care for the rest of her natural life. And then there's some other non-economic, lost wages of about another $1.1 million. And basically, by the time we get to her economic loss, it's a total of roughly $18 million. Okay, what about the non-economic award? Okay, so the total of the jury's award is $24 million. And the defendant says, too much. What is the appellate court say? Why not? First of all, let's get the standard out here. By what yardstick do we measure whether an award is too much or not? Okay. But again, what's the standard? An award is too much if it is... Okay, and we basically then look at the evidence. We ask whether the award is supported by the evidence. So we say, in effect, could the jury get here to this award from the evidence that was presented? What was the most important piece of evidence presented by the plaintiff in arriving at this $18 million verdict? Okay. So there's testimony from the doctors just about the severity of the injury and the kind of medical care she's going to require. There's another very important piece of evidence here justifying this $18 million award. Well, that's going to affect her wage loss. It's also going to affect her pain and suffering. But in order to get $125,000 a year over 70 years to equal $18 million or $16 million or whatever it is, what do we need? What kind of expert do we need? Yeah, an economics expert. We need an expert witness, an economist, who's going to be able to do that stuff about the federal funds discount rate and subprime, you know, blah, 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 and, you know, running this out and showing you charts and graphs and so forth. You can imagine that when the plaintiff was getting this case ready for trial and spent time shopping for an expert, this expert's testimony was absolutely critical. First of all, that it would be the kind of thing that you could point to on appeal if you did get a huge award like this. And then you need it to be presented in a user-friendly way so the jury gets it, the jury finds this expert credible, persuasive, and winds up saying, yeah, $16 million sounds good to us. Now, by contrast, what evidence did the defendant present to counter this? But at the trial, the plaintiffs, I mean, you can imagine they spent $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 on this economist to prepare the most persuasive case. If you're the defense and this is a high-stakes kind of case, what kind of expert did they put on? Nobody. Did they forget? Why would they not put on their own expert? Yeah, do you want him to say it's only $14.7 million? Or, no, you used the wrong, you know, the President's Council on Economic blah, 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 you know, from the 1958 to... You don't want to argue technicalities with it, because that's a game. You're only going to reinforce the notion that the plaintiff's economist is doing something respectable. The best you can do if you're the defense is to say, wait a minute, what was this guy's testimony? It's going to cost $125,000 a year. How much if you took $16 million, that was the medical expense, you put $16 million into a conservative investment, what are you going to get out of that, $800,000 a year? Well, this may be a little bit generous now. Maybe you're down to $500,000 a year if you have $16 million in a relatively conservative, you know, AAA grade bonds or whatever they are. Get 3% interest on $16 million. That's half a million. Well, gee, I only have to spend $125,000. How did we get there? Something's goofy here. And again, the defense is caught between a rock and a hard place. They put on their own expert. He or she is going to, in effect, reinforce the methodology that's being used. But in the end, the jury said we find this persuasive, and again, the plaintiffs played their cards right, created a record that the appellate court said this was for the jury to evaluate. Similarly with the pain and suffering, is $6 million excessive? Why not? And extremely, you know, extremely challenging physical ailments, you know, that would cause her a lot of pain, discomfort, embarrassment, etc. Would really, and then she's her intellectual capacity will be that of a 5-year-old. So again, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer and you do a day in the life of Nicole Fortman, you wheel her in, of course, to the courtroom every day so the jury gets to know her a little bit, and you basically, you know, you talk about Nicole. She's never going to go to the prom. She's never going to be able to cheer for her high school football team, or maybe she will, but, you know, she'll never go to high school. And, again, by the time you're done, you want the jury to just want to write her the biggest check they can. In the end, of course, let's see, the plaintiff's lawyer gets 40% of this plus, you know, the plaintiff's lawyer takes close to 10 of that, the plaintiff walks away with 14. She's got a lifetime of injury. The lawyer makes $10 million. Maybe it's only 8. It's a lot of money. This is the kind of case that plaintiff's lawyers dream about. One case like this and I can retire. Or continue being a lawyer as a hobby. Is there something wrong with that? Or is this precisely because of the potential for a case like this that a lawyer can do a really, really good job, find that economist who will put it in terms that the jury will accept and the appellate court will affirm? Now, one of the reasons for this case being here, in addition to the basic point about, you know, the discretion of the jury, is to set us up for the next case, Fine versus Permanente, which is where the defendants say, stop, time out, we got to change course here. This system is careening out of control. And I want to make clear, we're going to start on fine on Monday. This is not a course in constitutional law. We'll talk a little bit about the constitutional standards. In particular, this equal protection challenge is related to the decision of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. The same constitutional analysis, it's kind of interesting. So I want to do a little bit of it, but you will not need to know the details of it on the exam. What I do want you to be aware of is the fact that for every tort reform statute, there are constitutional challenges that say, no, legislature, you can't do that. So that's where we'll pick up on Monday. Yeah. Yeah.
Not states, but there are some states that have
joint custody.
No, friendly parent legislation.
Oh yeah.
Joint custody almost never
works. Right.
Right. But in friendly parent, which you have to place the child with a friendly parent, actually lost it. And this sort of client that he got through the court, $3.5 million because he weighed $2 million higher in touch for law.
Right.